At the earliest opportunity, said Peter, plebiscites will be held in all the ratifying nations. In the future, however, plebiscites will precede a nation's entry into the free people of Earth. We will maintain capitals in three places, Ribeirão Preto, Brazil, Kigali, Rwanda, and Rotterdam in the Netherlands. However, because the official language of the FPE is common, and few people find the pronunciation of Ribeirão Preto comfortable, the reporters laughed, since they were the ones who had to bear the brunt of learning to pronounce the Portuguese nasals. Therefore, Peter continued, the Brazilian government has kindly allowed us to translate the name of the city for world government purposes. From now on, you may refer to the South American capital of the FPE as Blackstream. One word. Will you do the same with Kigali? Shouted a reporter. Since you are able to pronounce it, said Peter, we will not. More laughter. Peter's acceptance of the question, however, opened the floodgates, and they began calling out to him. He raised his hands. In a minute. Be patient. They quieted down. There is a reason why we have chosen the name Free People of Earth for our constitution, instead of, say, United Nations. Another laugh. They all knew why that name wouldn't be used. This constitution is a contract among free citizens, not between nations. The old borders will be respected insofar as they make sense, and where they don't, adjustments will be made, and people who have long been deprived of legally recognized national boundaries and self-government will receive those things within the FPE. Two new lights appeared, blinking a deeper blue. One cut a large swath across the Andes. The other took a chunk out of southwestern Sudan. The FPE immediately recognizes the existence of the nations of Nubia in Africa and Runa in South America. Plebiscites will be held immediately, and if the people of these regions vote to ratify the Constitution, then the FPE will act vigorously to protect their borders. You will notice that part of the territory of Runa has been voluntarily contributed by the nations of Bolivia and Ecuador as one of the terms of their entry into the FPE. The free people of Earth salute the far-sighted and generous leaders of these nations. Peter leaned forward. The FPE will act vigorously to protect the electoral process. Any attempt to interfere with these plebiscites will be regarded as an act of war against the free people of Earth. There was the gauntlet. The questioning afterward, as Peter had hoped, focused on the two new nations whose boundaries included territory belonging to nations that had not ratified, Peru and Sudan. Instead of being peppered with skeptical questions about the FPE itself, Peter had already settled the question of how serious they were. Taking on Peru was bad enough. No one doubted the ability of the FPE to crush the Peruvian military. It was Sudan, a Muslim country, which had given its allegiance to Caliph Ali. "Are you declaring war against Caliph Ali?" demanded a reporter for an Arab news service. "We declare war against no one. But the people of Nubia have a long history of oppression, atrocities, famine, and religious intolerance committed against them by the government of Sudan. How many times in the past 200 years has international action caused Sudan to promise to do better? Yet in the aftermath of Caliph Ali's astonishing unification of the Muslim world, the outlaws and criminals in Sudan immediately took this as permission to renew their genocidal treatment of the Nubians. If Caliph Ali wishes to defend the criminals of Sudan, even as he repudiates those of India, that is his choice. One thing is certain, any right the Sudanese might once have claimed to rule over Nubia has long since expired. The Nubian people have been united by war and suffering into a nation that deserves statehood and protection." Peter ended the press conference soon afterward, announcing that Starman, Bellini, and Boom would each hold press conferences 2 days later in their home countries. But the armed forces, border guards, and customs services of these nations are now all under the control of the FPE. There is no such thing as a Rwandan or Brazilian military, only the military of the FPE. "Wait," cried one reporter. "There's no hegemon in this whole constitution." Peter returned to the microphone. "Fast reading," he said. Laughter, then expectant silence. The office of hegemon was created to meet an emergency that threatened the entire Earth. I will continue as hegemon under both the original authority under which I was selected for the office and under temporary authorization from the FPE, until such time as no serious military threat against the free people of Earth exists. At that time, I will resign my office, and there will be no successor. I am the last hegemon, and I hope to give up the office as quickly as possible. Peter left again, and this time ignored the shouted questions.
As expected, Peru and Sudan didn't even declare war, since they refused to recognize the legitimacy of the FPE or the new nations carved from their territory. Whom would they declare war against? Peruvian troops moved first, heading for known hideouts of Champititu's revolutionary movement. Some of them were empty, but some of them were defended by highly trained Rwandan soldiers. Peter was using Bean's Rwandans so that it wouldn't be perceived as another war between Brazil and Peru. It had to be the FPE defending a member state's borders. The Peruvian armies found themselves caught in well-laid traps, with sizable forces moving in across their lines of supply and communication. It quickly became known throughout Peru that the Rwandan troops were better trained and better equipped than the Peruvian army, and they were led by Julian Delfiki, Bean, the giant. Morale collapsed. Rwandan troops accepted the surrender of the entire Peruvian army. The Peruvian Congress immediately voted almost unanimously to petition the FPE for membership. Radagast Bellini, as interim president of the South American region of the FPE, declined their offer, stating the principle that no territory would be added to the FPE by conquest or intimidation. "We invite the nation of Peru to hold a plebiscite, and if the people of Peru choose to join the free people of Earth, we will welcome them to join with their brothers and sisters of Runa, Bolivia, Ecuador, and Chile." It was over in 2 weeks, plebiscite and all. Peru was part of the FPE, and Bean and the bulk of the FPE's Rwandan troops were transported back across the Atlantic to Africa. As a direct result of this decisive action, Belize, Cayenne, Costa Rica, and the Dominican Republic announced that they would hold plebiscites on the Constitution. The rest of the world waited to see what would happen in Sudan. Sudanese troops were already spread throughout Nubia. They were already engaged in military actions against the Nubian rebels who were resisting the renewed attempt to impose Sharia on the Christian and pagan region. So while there were plenty of acts of defiance against Peter's proclamation of Nubia's new status, there was no actual change. Suryawang, leading the elite corps of the FPE military that he and Bean had created years before and used so effectively since, conducted a series of raids designed to demoralize the Sudanese military and cut them off from their supplies. Ammunition dumps and arsenals were destroyed. Convoys were burned. But since Suri's choppers returned to Rwanda after every raid, there was no one for the Sudanese military to strike back against. Then Bean returned with the bulk of the Rwandan soldiers. Burundi and Uganda both granted permission for him to transport his army across their territory. As expected, the Sudanese army tried to strike at Bean's army inside the borders of Uganda before they reached Nubia. Only then did they discover that this army was an illusion. There was nothing to strike but a bunch of old and empty trucks whose drivers fled at the first sign of trouble. But it was a strike on Ugandan territory. Uganda not only declared war on Sudan, it also announced a plebiscite on the constitution. Meanwhile, Bean's army had already traversed the eastern reaches of Congo and were inside Nubia, and Suriyawong's strike force took over the two air bases to which the planes that had taken part in the attack on the decoy convoy had to return. The pilots landed without suspecting any problem and were taken prisoner. The trained jet pilots among Suriyawong's soldiers immediately took off again in Sudanese planes and carried out a demonstration bombing against the air defenses of Khartoum. And Bean's army made simultaneous attacks on all the Sudanese military bases inside Nubia. Unprepared to fight against a real army, the Sudanese forces surrendered or were overwhelmed within the day. Sudan called on Caliph Ali to intervene and bring the wrath of Islam down on the heads of the infidel invaders. Peter held an immediate press conference. "The free people of earth do not conquer. The Muslim portions of Sudan will be respected, and all prisoners will be returned as soon as we have the pledge of Caliph Ali and of the Sudanese government that they recognize Nubia as a nation and as part of the free people of earth. The Sudanese Air Force will be returned to Sudan along with their air bases. We respect the sovereignty of Sudan and of all nations, but we will never recognize the right of any nation to persecute a stateless minority within their borders. When it is within our power, we will grant such minorities a state within the constitution of the free people of earth and defend their national existence. Julian Delfiki is commander of all FPE forces within Nubia and temporarily occupying portions of Sudan. It would be a tragedy if two old friends from the war against the buggers, Julian Delfiki and Caliph Ali, should face each other in combat over an issue as ridiculous as whether Sudan should have the right to continue persecuting non-Muslims." Negotiators soon redrew the boundaries so that a significant portion of what Peter had originally declared to be Nubia would remain in Sudan. Of course, he had never expected to keep that territory, and the Nubian leaders already knew that. But it was sufficient for Caliph Ali to save face. In the end, Bean and Suriyawong spent their efforts returning prisoners and protecting the convoys of non-Muslims who chose to leave their homes inside Sudanese territory and find new homes in their new nation. In the aftermath of this clear victory, the FPE was so wildly popular in Black Africa that nation after nation petitioned to hold a plebiscite. Felix Starman informed most of them that they had to reform their internal government first, providing human rights and elections. But the plebiscites in the democracies of South Africa, Nigeria, Namibia, Uganda, and Burundi proceeded immediately, and it was clear that the free people of Earth had real existence as an intercontinental state with convincing military power and resolute leadership. As Colombia now accepted the borders of Runa and petitioned to become part of the FPE, it seemed inevitable now that all of Latin America and sub-Saharan Africa would be part of the FPE, and sooner rather than later. There was movement elsewhere, too. Belgium, Bulgaria, Latvia, Lithuania, and Slovakia began to plan for their own plebiscites, as did the Philippines, Fiji, and most of the tiny island nations of the Pacific. And, of course, the FPE capitals were flooded with pleas from minorities that wanted the FPE to grant them nationhood. Most of these had to be ignored, for now.
On the day that Sudan, under enormous pressure from Caliph Ali, recognized both Nubia and the FPE, Peter was surprised to see his office door open and his parents come in. "What's wrong?"
"Nothing's wrong," said Mother.
"We came to tell you," said Father, "that we're very proud of you." Peter shook his head. "It's only the first step in a long road.
We don't have 20% of the world's population yet, and it will take time to integrate these new nations into the FVE. First step on the right road, said Father. A year ago, if somebody had put up a list of these nations, said Mother, and said that they would ever unite into one coherent nation under a single constitution and surrender command of their armed forces to the hegemon, is there anyone who would not have laughed? It's all thanks to Alai and Valomi, said Peter. The atrocities committed by the Muslims in India and the publicity Valomi gave those actions, combined with all the recent wars, terrified everybody, said Father. But the nations joining the FPE are not the ones that were most afraid. No, Peter, it was your constitution. It was you. Your achievements in the past, the promises you were making for the future. It was the battle schooler, said Peter, without Bean's reputation, so you used the tools you had, said Mother. Lincoln had Grant, Churchill had Montgomery. It's part of their greatness that they weren't so jealous of their generals that they had to depose them. So, you won't let me talk you out of this, said Peter. Your place in history was already assured by your work as Locke before you ever became hegemon, said Father. But today, Peter, you became a great man. They stood in the doorway for a long moment. Well, that's what we came to say, said Mother. Thanks, said Peter. They left, pulling the door closed behind them. Peter went back to the papers on his desk, and then discovered that he couldn't see them because of the tears blurring his eyes. He sat up and found himself gasping, no, sobbing, quietly, but his body was racked with sobs, as if he had just been relieved of a terrible burden, as if he had just learned that his terminal disease had spontaneously healed itself, as if he had just had a long-lost child returned to him. Not once in that whole conversation had anybody said the name Ender, or referred to him in any way. It was a full 5 minutes before Peter got control of himself. He had to get up and wash his face in the tiny bathroom in his office before he could get back to work.
Chapter 16. Jish. From Weaver. Verlomi at motherindia.in.net. To Peter Wiggin, private at hegemon.gov. Ray. Conversation. I have never met you, but I admire your achievements. Come visit me. V. From Peter Wiggin, private at hegemon.gov, to Weaver, Verlomi at motherindia.in.net. Ray, meeting. I also admire your achievements. I will happily provide safe transportation for you to the FPE or any other site outside of India. While it is still under Muslim occupation, I do not travel to India. P.W. From Weaver, Verlomi at motherindia.in.net, to Peter Wiggin, private at hegemon.gov, Ray, place. I will not set foot on any country but India. You will not enter India. Therefore, Colombo, Sri Lanka. I will come in a boat. Mine will not be comfortable. If you bring a better one, we'll enjoy our visit much more. Thee.
Fly Molo met Bean at the Manila airport and did his best not to look shocked at how tall Bean was. You said your business was personal, said Fly. Forgive my suspicious nature. You are the head of FPE Armed Forces, and I am head of Filipino Armed Forces, and yet we have nothing to discuss? I'm assuming that your military is superbly trained and well-equipped. Yes, said Fly. Then until it's time for us to deploy somewhere, our planning and logistics departments have far more to say to each other than you or I do. officially speaking. So, you're here as a friend. I'm here, said Bean, because I have a child in Manila, a boy. They tell me his name is Ramon. Fly grinned. And yet this is your first time here? Who was the mother, a flight attendant? The baby was stolen from me, Fly, as an embryo, in vitro fertilization. The child is mine and Petra's. It's especially important to us because it's the first we know of that definitely does not have my condition. You mean it isn't ugly? Bean laughed. You've done well here in the Philippines, my friend. It's easy. Somebody argues with me, I just say, I was in Ender's Jeesh, and they shut up and do what I say. It's just like that for me, too. Except for Peter. Especially Peter, said Bean. I'm the power behind the throne, didn't you know? Don't you read the papers? I notice the papers love to mention your zero wins record as a commander in battle school. Some achievements are so extraordinary, said Bean, that you never live them down. How's Petra? Asked Fly. And they talked about people they both knew and reminisced about battle school and command school and the war with the buggers until they got to a private home in the hills east of Manila. There were several cars in front. Two soldiers wearing their new FPE uniforms stood at either side of the door. Guards? Asked Bean. Fly shrugged. Not my idea. They did not have to prove who they were, and when they got inside, they realized that this was not the meeting either of them expected. It was a reunion, apparently, of Ender's Jeesh, those that were available. Dink, Shen, Vlad on one side of a long table. Crazy Tom, Karn Karbi, and Dumper, Champ Titu, on the other. And at the head of the table, Graf and Rackham. Now all are here that were invited, said Graf. Please, Fly, Bean, take your seats. Bean, I trust that you will tell Petra all that goes on here. As for Hanzu and Caliph Alai, they're now heads of state and don't travel easily or surreptitiously. However, everything we say to you will be said to them. I know some people who'd like to bomb this room, said Vlad. There's still someone unaccounted for, said Shen. Ender is voyaging safely. His ship is functioning perfectly. His Ansible works well. Remember, though, that for him it has been scarcely a year since this group destroyed the Hive Queens. Even if you could talk to him, he would seem young. The world has changed. And so have you. Graf glanced back at Rackham. Mazer and I are deeply concerned about you and about the world as a whole. We're doing all right, said Karn Karbi. And thanks to Bean and Ender's big brother, maybe the world is too, said Dumper. He said it a little defiantly, as if he expected to be argued with. I don't give a rat's ass about the world, said Bean. I'm being blackmailed into helping Peter, and not by Peter. Bean is referring to a bargain he entered into with me of his own free will, said Graf. What's this meeting about? Asked Dink. You're not our teacher anymore. He glanced up at Rackham. You're not our commander, either. We haven't forgotten how you both lied to us continually. We never could convince you of our sincere devotion to your welfare back in school, Dink, said Graf. So, as Dink requests, I won't waste time on preliminaries. Look around this table. How old are you?
Old enough to know better, muttered Karn.
What are you, Bean? 16? Asked Fly.
I was never actually born, said Bean, and the records of my decanting were destroyed when I was about a year old, but 16 is probably close.
And all the rest of us must be around 20, give or take, said Fly. What's your point, Colonel Graf?
Call me Hiram, said Graf. I'd like to think we're colleagues now.
Colleagues in what? Muttered Dink.
Back when you last met, said Graf, when Ashiel arranged for your kidnapping in Russia. You were already held in high esteem throughout the world. You were regarded as having potential. Since then, however, one of your number has become Caliph. unified the ununifiable Muslim world and masterminded the conquest of China and the liberation of India.
Ali's lost his mind, that's what he's done, said Karn.
And Hanzu is emperor of China. Bean is commander of the undefeated armies of the FPE, plus being known as the man who finally brought a shield down. All in all, what once was viewed as potential is now regarded as a certainty.
So, what have you assembled here? Said Crazy Tom.
The losers? I've assembled the people that national governments will turn to stop Peter Wiggin from uniting the world.
They looked around at each other.
Nobody's talked to me yet, said Fly Molo. But they turned to you to put down the Muslim rebellion in the Philippines, didn't they? Said Rackham.
We're citizens of our countries, said Crazy Tom.
Mine rents me out, said Dink, like a taxi.
Because you always get along so well with authority, said Crazy Tom.
Here's what will happen, said Graf. Some combination of China, India, and the Muslim world destroy each other. Whichever one emerges on top, Bean destroys on the battlefield on behalf of the FPE. Does anyone doubt he can do it?
Bean raised his hand.
No one else did.
And then Dink did.
He's not hungry, he said.
No one argued with him.
Now, what could Dink possibly mean by that? Said Graf.
Any ideas?
No one seemed to have any. You don't want to say it, but I will, said Graf. It's well known that Bean scored higher on the battle school tests than anyone else in history. No one else was close.
Well, Ender, but close is such a relative term. Let's say Ender scored closest. But we don't know how close because Bean was off the charts.
How? Said Dink.
He answered questions you didn't ask?
Exactly, said Graf. That's what Sister Carlotta showed me. He had time to spare in taking the tests. He commented on them and mentioned how the test could have been improved. He was unstoppable, irresistible. That's what the world knows about Julian Delfiki. And yet, when we put him in charge of all of you on Eros in command school, while we were waiting for Ender to make up his mind about whether to continue his education, how did that go?
Again, silence.
Oh, why must we pretend that things weren't as they were, said Graf.
We didn't like it, said Dink. He was younger than all of us.
So was Ender, said Graf.
But we knew Ender, said Crazy Tom.
We loved Ender, said Shen.
Everybody loved Ender, said Fly.
I can give you a list of people who hated him, but you loved him. And you didn't love Bean. Why is that?
Bean barked out a laugh. The others looked at him, except the ones who were embarrassed and looked away.
I never learned how to be cuddly, said Bean. In an orphanage, that would have got me adopted, but on the street, it would have got me killed.
Nonsense, said Graf. Cuddly wouldn't have cut it with this group anyway.
And you actually were cuddly, said Karn. No offense, but you were spunky.
If that's your word for bratty little asshole, said Dink mildly.
Now, said Graf. You didn't dislike Bean personally, most of you, but you didn't like serving under him. And you can't say that it's because you were too independent to serve under anybody, because you gladly served under Ender. You gave Ender everything you had.
More than we had, said Fly.
But not Bean.
Graf said it like it was proof of something.
Is this a therapy group? Asked Dink.
Vlad spoke up.
Of course it is. He wants us to reach the same conclusion he's already reached.
Do you know what it is? Asked Graf.
Vlad took a breath.
Hiram thinks that the reason we didn't follow Bean the way we followed Ender was because we knew something about Bean that the rest of the world doesn't know. And because of that, we're likely to be willing to challenge him in battle, while the rest of the world would just give up and surrender to him because of his reputation.
Isn't that about it?
Graf smiled benignly.
But that's stupid, said Dumper. Bean really is a good commander. I've seen him. commanding his Rwandans in our campaign in Peru. It's true that the Peruvian army wasn't well-led or well-trained, but those Rwandans, they worshipped Bean. They would have marched off a cliff if he asked them to. When he twitched, they sprang into action.
And your point is? Asked Dink.
My point is, said Dumper, we didn't follow him well, but other people do. Bean's the real thing. He's still the best of us.
I haven't seen his Rwandans, said Fly, but I've seen him with the men he and Suriyawang trained. Back when the forces of the hegemon were 100 guys and 2 choppers, Dumper's right. Alexander the Great couldn't have had soldiers more devoted and more effective.
Thanks for the testimonials, boys, said Bean. But you're missing Hiram's point.
Hiram, muttered Dink, aren't we cozy?
Just tell them, said Bean.
They know it, but they don't know that they know it.
You tell them, said Graf.
Is this a Chinese re-education camp? Do we have to indulge in self-criticism?
Bean laughed bitterly.
It's what Dink said right at the start. I'm not hungry, which might seem stupid considering I've spent my whole infancy starving to death, but I'm not hungry for supremacy, and all of you are.
That's the great secret of the tests, said Graf.
Sister Carlotta gave the standard battery of tests we used, but there was an additional test, one that I gave, or one of my most trusted aides. A test of ambition, competitive ambition. You all scored very, very high. Bean didn't.
Bean's not ambitious?
Bean wants victory, said Graf. He likes to win. He needs to win. But he doesn't need to beat anybody.
We all cooperated with Ender, said Karn. We didn't have to beat him.
But you knew he would lead you to victory. And in the meanwhile, you were all competing with each other. Except Bean.
Only because he was better than any of us. Why compete if you've won, said Fly.
If any one of you came up against Bean in battle, who would win? They rolled their eyes or chuckled or otherwise showed their derision for the question.
That would depend, said Karn Karby, on the terrain and the weather and the sign of the zodiac. Nothing sure in war, is it?
There wasn't any weather in the battle room, said Fly, grinning. You can conceive of beating Bean, can't you? Said Graf. And it's possible, because Bean is only better than the rest of you if all else is equal. Only it never is. And one of the most important variables in war is the hunger that makes you take ridiculous chances because you intuit that there's a path to victory and you have to take that path because anything other than winning is inconceivable, unbearable.
Very poetic, said Dink. The romance of war.
Look at Lee, said Graf.
Which one, said Shen, the Chinese or the American?
Lee, L-E-E, the Virginian, said Graf. When the enemy was on Virginia's soil, he won. He took the chances he needed to take. He sent Stonewall Jackson out on a forest path at Chancellorsville, dividing his forces and exposing himself dangerously against Hooker, exactly the sort of reckless commander who could have exploited the opportunity if he'd realized it.
Hooker was an idiot.
We say that because he lost, said Graf. But would he have lost if Lee had not taken the dangerous move he took? My point isn't to refight Chancellorsville. My point is Antietam and Gettysburg, said Bean.
Exactly.
As soon as Lee left Virginia and entered Northern Territory, he wasn't hungry anymore. He believed in the cause of defending Virginia, but he did not believe in the cause of slavery, and he knew that's what the war was about. He didn't want to see his state defeated, but he didn't want to see the Southern cause win, all unconsciously. He didn't know this about himself, but it was true. It had nothing to do with the North's overwhelming force. Lee lost at Antietam against the second stupidest and most timid commander the North had, McClellan. And Meade at Gettysburg wasn't terribly imaginative. Meade saw the high ground and he took it. And what did Lee do? Based on how Lee acted in all his Virginia campaigns, What would you have expected Lee to do?
Refuse to fight on that ground, said Fly. Maneuver. Slide right, steal a march. Get between Meade and Washington. Find a battlefield where the Union would have to try to force his position.
He was low on supplies, said Dink, and he didn't have the information from his cavalry.
Excuses, said Vlad. No excuses in war. Graf is right. Lee didn't act like Lee once he left Virginia.
But that's Lee. What does that have to do with Bean?
He thinks, said Bean, that when I don't believe in a cause, I can be beaten. That I would beat myself. The trouble is that I do believe in the cause. I think Peter Wiggin is a decent man. Ruthless, but I've seen how he uses power, and he doesn't use it to hurt anybody. He really is trying to create a world order that leads to peace. I want him to win. I want him to win quickly. And if any of you think you can stop me...
We don't have to stop you, said Crazy Tom. We just have to hold out until you're dead.
Utter silence. There it is, said Graf. There's the whole point of this meeting. Bean only has a little while. So while he lives, the hegemon is perceived as unbeatable. But the moment he's gone, what then? Dumper or Fly would probably be appointed commander after him, since they're already inside the FPE. But every one of you at this table would feel perfectly free to take on either of them, am I right?
Hell, Hiram, said Dink.
We'd take on Bean. And so the world would be torn apart, and the FPE, even if it was victorious, would stand on the bodies of millions of soldiers who died because of your competitive ambition. He looked fiercely around the table.
Hey, said Fly. We haven't killed anybody yet. Talk to Hot Soup and Ali about that.
Look at Ali, said Graf. It took him 2 purges to get real control over the Islamic forces, but now he has it. And what has he done? Has he left India? Has he withdrawn from Xinjiang or Tibet? Have the Indonesian Muslims left Taiwan? He remains face to face with Hansa. Why is that? It makes no sense. He can't hold India. He couldn't rule over China. But he has Genghis dreams.
It always comes back to Genghis, said Vlad.
You all want the world united, said Graf, but you want to do it yourselves, because you can't stand the thought of anyone else standing on top of the hill.
Come on, said Dink. In our hearts, we're all Cincinnatus. We can hardly wait to get back to the farm.
They laughed. At this table sits 50 years of bloody war, said Graf.
What about it? Said Dink.
We didn't invent war. We're just good at it. War gets invented every time there's somebody so hungry for domination that he can't leave peaceful nations alone. It is precisely people like you that invent war. Even if you have a cause, like Lee did, would the South have struggled on for all those bloody years of civil war if they hadn't had the firm belief that no matter what happened, Mars Robert would save them? Even if you don't make the decision for war, nations will enter into wars only because they have you.
So what's your solution, Hiram? Said Dink. You have little cyanide pills for us all to swallow so we can save the world from ourselves?
It would help, said Vlad. Even if what you're saying is true, there are other battle school graduates. Look at Virlomi. She's outmaneuvered everybody.
She hasn't outmaneuvered a lie yet, said Crazy Tom. Or Hot Soup.
Vlad insisted on his point. Look at Suriyawang. That's who Peter will turn into after Bean retires. We weren't the only kids at battle school.
Ender's Jeesh, said Graf. You're the ones who saved the world.
You're the ones with the magic. And there are hundreds and hundreds of battle school grads on Earth. Nobody is going to think that just because they happen to have 1 or 2 or 5, they can conquer the world. Which one of them would it be?
So you want to be rid of us all, said Dink. And that's why you brought us here. We're not leaving here alive, are we?
Lighten up, Dink, said Graf.
You can all go home as soon as this meeting is over. Cole Min doesn't assassinate people.
Now that's an interesting point, said Crazy Tom. What does Cole Min do?
It packs people into starships like sardines, and then it sends them off to colony worlds, and they'll never come back, not to the world they left. 50 years out, 50 years back, the world would have forgotten all of us by then, even if we went to a colony and came right home, which, of course, he wouldn't let us do.
So this isn't an assassination, said Dink. It's another damn kidnapping.
It's an offer, said Rackham, which you can accept or decline.
I decline, said Dink.
Hear the offer, said Rackham.
Hear this, said Dink, with a gesture.
I offer you command of a colony, each one of you. No rivals. We don't know of any enemy armies for you to face, but there will be worlds full of danger and uncertainty, and your abilities will be highly adaptable. People will follow you. People older than you, partly because you are Ender's Geesh, and partly because, mostly because of your own abilities. They'll see how quickly you grasp important information, rank it by priority, foresee consequences, and make correct decisions. You'll be the founders of new human worlds. Crazy Tom put on a baby talk voice.
Will they name the planets after us?
Don't be such a dull bob, said Karn.
Sorry.
Look, gents, said Graf. We saw what happened to the Hive Queens. They bunched up on one planet and they got wiped out in a single blow. Any weapon we can invent, an enemy can also invent and use against us.
Come on, said Dink. The Hive Queens spread out and colonized as many planets as you're colonizing. In fact, all you're doing is sending ships to colonize the worlds they already settled because they're the only ones you know about that have an atmosphere we can breathe and flora and fauna we can eat.
Actually, we're taking our own flora and fauna with us, said Graf.
Dink's right, said Shen. Dispersal didn't work for the Hive Queens.
Because they didn't disperse, said Graf. They had buggers on all the planets. But when you boys blew up their home world, all the Hive Queens were there. They put all their eggs in one basket. We're not going to do that. Partly because the human race isn't just a handful of queens and a whole bunch of workers and drones. Every damn one of us is a Hive Queen and has the seeds of recapitulating the whole of human history. So dispersing humanity will work.
Like coughing in a crowd spreads the flu, said Crazy Tom cheerfully.
Exactly, said Graf. Call us a disease, I don't care. I am a human, and I want us to spread everywhere like an epidemic, so we can never be stamped out. Rackham nodded. And to accomplish that, he needs his colonies to have the best possible chance of survival. Which means you, said Graf. If I can get you.
So we make your colonies work, said Karn. And you get us off Earth, too, so Peter can end all war and bring the millennial reign of Christ.
Whether Christ comes or not isn't my business, said Graf. All I care about is saving human beings, collectively and individually.
Aren't you the noble one?
No, said Graf. I created you. Not you individually.
Good thing you said that, said Karn, because my dad would have had to kill you for that aspersion on my mother.
I found you. I tested you. I assembled you. I made the whole world aware of you. The danger you represent, I created it.
So you're really trying to atone for your mistakes?
It wasn't a mistake. It was essential to winning the last war. But it's not unusual in history for the solution to one problem to become the root of the next one.
So this meeting is cleanup, said Fly.
This meeting is to offer you a chance to do something that will satisfy your own irresistible craving for supremacy while ensuring the survival of the human race, both here on Earth and out there in the galaxy.
They thought about that for a moment. Dumper was the first to speak.
I've already chosen my life's work, Colonel Graf.
It's Hiram, Dink whispered loudly, because he's our buddy.
You chose it, said Graf, and you accomplished it. Your people have a nation, and you're part of the FPE. That struggle is over for you. All that's left is for you to chafe under Peter Wiggins' rule until you either rebel against him or become his military commander, and then his replacement as hegemon, ruling the world. Am I close?
I have no such plans, said Dumper.
But it resonates with you, said Graf. Don't pretend otherwise. I know you boys. You're not crazy, you're not evil, but you can't stop.
That's why you didn't invite Petra, said Bean. Because then you couldn't have said, you boys, all the time.
You forget, said Dink. We're his colleagues now, so we can call him and Rackham you boys, too.
Graf stood up from his seat at the head of the table. I've made the offer. You'll think about it, whether you mean to or not. You'll watch events unfold. You all know how to contact me. The offer is open. We're done here for today.
No, we're not, said Shen, because you aren't doing anything about the real problem.
Which is?
We're just potential warmongers and baby killers, said Shen. You're not doing a thing about hot soup and a lie.
And Verlomi, added Fly Molo. If you want somebody who's dangerous, it's her.
They will get the same offer as you, said Rackham. In fact, one of them already has.
Which one? Asked Dink.
The one who was in a position to hear it, said Graf.
Hot soup, then, said Shen, because you couldn't even get in to meet Mr. Caliph.
What smart fellows you all turned out to be, said Graf. Waterloo was won, quoted Rackham, on the playing fields of Eton.
What the hell does that mean? Asked Karn Carby. You never even went to Eton.
It was an analogy, said Rackham. If you hadn't spent your entire childhood playing war games, you'd actually know something. You're all so uneducated.
Chapter 17 Boats From Champy Titu at runa.gov.qu To Wallaby Wannabe Boy Genius at stratplan.mil.gov.au. Ray, good idea. Of course Graf's offer sounded like a good idea to you. You live in Australia. Dumper. From Wallaby Wannabe, Boy Genius at stratplan.mil.gov.au to Champy, Titu at runa.gov.qu. Ray, ha ha. People who live on the moon, pardon me, the Andes, shouldn't joke about Australia. Karn. From Champy, Titu at runa.gov.qu to Wallaby Wannabe, Boy Genius at stratplan.mil.gov.au. Ray, who was joking? I've seen Australia, and I've lived on an asteroid, and I'd take the asteroid. Dumper. From Wallaby Wannabe, Boy Genius at stratplan.mil.gov.au to Champy, Titu at runa.gov.qu. Ray, asteroid. Australia doesn't need life support like an asteroid or coca like the Andes to be livable. Besides, you only like the asteroid because it was named Eros, and that's as close to sex as you've ever gotten. Karn. From Champy, Titu at runa.gov.qu to Wallaby Wannabe, Boy Genius at stratplan.mil.gov.au. Ray, at least. At least I have a sex. Male, by the way. Open your fly and check to see what you are. You grip the handle of the zipper and pull downward. Oh, wait, you're in Australia. Upward, then. Dumper. From Wallaby Wannabe, Boy Genius at stratplan.mil.gov.au to Champy, Titu at runa.gov.qu. Ray, let's see. Zipper, fly, pull. Ouch! Ow! Owie! Karn.
The sailors were so nervous to have the lady aboard their dhow that it was a wonder they didn't swamp the boat just getting out to sea. And sailing was slow, with lots of tacking. Even turning the ship seemed to require as much work as the reinvention of navigation. Vrilomi showed none of her impatience, though. It was time for the next step, for India to reach for the world stage. She needed an ally to free her nation from the foreign occupiers. Even though the atrocities had ended, nothing filmable now, Ali persisted in keeping his Muslim troops all over India, waiting for Hindu provocations, knowing that Vrilomi couldn't control her people as tightly as Ali now controlled his troops. But she wasn't going to bring Hunsu into the picture. She had fought too hard to get the Chinese out of India to invite them back again. Besides, even though they had no religion to force on people like Ali's Muslims, the Chinese were just as arrogant, just as sure they were entitled to rule the world. And these Jeesh boys, they were so sure they could be her masters. Didn't they understand that her whole life was a repudiation of their sense of superiority? They had been chosen to wage war against aliens. The gods fought on their side in that war. But now the gods fought on Vrilomi's side. She hadn't been a believer when she began. She exploited her knowledge of the folk religion of her people. But over the weeks and months and years of her campaign against China, and then against the Muslims, she had seen how everything bent and turned to fit her plans. Everything she thought of worked, and since there were tests proving that Ali and Hunsu were smarter than she was, it must be that entities wiser than they were providing her with her ideas. There was only one person now who could give her the help she needed, and only one man in the world whom it would not demean her to marry. After all, when she married, it would be all India marrying, and whatever children she bore would be the children of a god, at least in the eyes of the people. Since parthenogenesis was out of the question, she needed a husband, and that's why she had summoned Peter Wigan. Wigan, the brother of the great Ender, the older brother. Who then could doubt that her children would carry the best genes available on Earth? They would found a dynasty that could unite the world and rule forever. By marrying her, Peter would be able to add India to his FPE, transforming it from a sideshow into more than half the population of the world. And she, and India, would be raised above any other nation. Instead of being the leader of a single nation like China, or the head of a brutal and backward religion like Ali, she would be the wife of the enlightened Locke, the hegemon of Earth, the man whose vision would bring peace to all the world at last. Peter's boat wasn't huge. Clearly, he wasn't a wasteful man, but it wasn't a primitive fisherman's dhow. Peter's boat had modern lines, and it looked as if it was designed to rise up and fairly fly over the waves. Speed. No time to waste in Peter Wigan's world. She had once belonged to that world. For years now, she had slowed herself down to the pace of life in India. She had walked slowly when people were watching her. She had to maintain the simple grace they expected of someone in her position. And she had to hold silence while men argued, speaking only as much as was appropriate for her to say. She could not afford to do anything to diminish herself in their eyes. But she missed the speed of things, the shuttles that took her to and from battle school and tactical school, the clean, polished surfaces, the quickness of games in the battle room, even the intensity of life in Hyderabad, among other battle schoolers, before she fled to let Bean know where Petra was. It was closer to her true inclinations than this pose of primitiveness. You do what victory requires. Those with armies train the armies. But when Vrilomi started, she had only herself, so she trained and disciplined herself to seem as she needed to seem. In the process, she had become what she needed to be. But that didn't mean she had lost her ability to admire the sleek, fast vessel that Peter had brought to her. The fisherman helped her out of the dhow and into the rowboat that would take her between the two vessels. Out in the Gulf of Mannar, There were undoubtedly much heavier waves, but the little islands of Adam's Bridge protected the water here, so it was only slightly choppy. Which was just as well. There was a faint nausea that had been with her ever since she got aboard. Vomiting was not something she needed to show these sailors. She hadn't expected seasickness. How could she have known she was susceptible? Helicopters didn't bother her, or cars on winding roads, or even free fall. Why should a bit of chop on the water nearly do her in? The rowboat was actually better than the dhow, more frightening but less nauseating. Fear she could deal with. Fear didn't make her want to throw up. It only made her more determined to win. Peter himself was at the side of his boat, and it was his hand that she took to help her climb aboard. That was a good sign. He wasn't trying to play games and force her to come to him. Peter had her men tie the dinghy to his craft, and then brought them aboard to rest in relative comfort on the deck while she went inside the main cabin with Peter. It was beautifully and comfortably decorated, but not overly large or pretentious. It struck just the right note of restrained opulence. A man of taste. "It's not my boat, of course," said Peter. "Why would I waste FPE money on owning a boat? This is a loan." She said nothing. After all, saying nothing was part of who she was now. But she was just a little disappointed. Modesty was one thing, but why did he feel compelled to tell her that he didn't own it, that he was frugal? Because he believed her image of seeking traditional Indian simplicity? No, poverty, as something she really meant, and not just something she staged in order to hold on to the hearts of the Indian people. "Well, I could hardly expect him to be as perceptive as me. He wasn't admitted to battle school, after all." "Have a seat," he said. "Are you hungry?" "No, thank you," she said softly. If only he knew what would happen to any food she tried to eat at sea. "Tea?" "Nothing," she said. He shrugged. With embarrassment? That she had turned him down? Really, was he such a boy as that? Was he taking this personally? Well, he was supposed to take it personally. He just didn't understand how or why. Of course he didn't. How could he imagine what she came to offer him? Time to be Verlomi. Time to let him know what this meeting was about. He was standing near a bar with a fridge, and seemed to be trying to choose between inviting her to sit with him at the table or on the soft chairs bolted to the deck. She took two steps and she was with him, pressing her body against his, entwining the arms of India under his and around his back. She stood on her toes and kissed his lips, not with vigor, but softly and warmly. It was not a girl's chaste kiss. It was a promise of love, as best she knew how to show it. She had not had that much experience before Ashil came and made Hyderabad a chaste and terrifying place to work. A few kisses with boys she knew. But she had learned something of what made them excited, and Peter was, after all, scarcely more than a boy, wasn't he? And it seemed to work. He certainly returned the kiss. It was going as she expected. The gods were with her. "Let's sit down," said Peter. But to her surprise, what he indicated was the table, not the soft chairs, not the wide one where they could have sat together. The table, where they would have a slab of wood, something cold and smooth anyway, between them. When they were seated, Peter looked at her quizzically. "Is that really what you came all this way for?" "What did you think?" she said. "I hoped it had something to do with India ratifying the FPE constitution." "I haven't read it," she said. "But you must know India doesn't surrender its sovereignty easily. It'll be easy enough if you ask the Indian people to vote for it. But you see, I need to know what India gets in return." "What every nation in the FPE receives. Peace, protection, free trade, human rights and elections." "That's what you give to Nigeria," said Verlomi. "That's what we give to Vanuatu and Kiribati, too, and the United States, and Russia, and China, and yes, India, when they choose to join us. India is the most populous nation on Earth, and she's spent the past 3 years fighting for her survival. She needs more than mere protection. She needs a special place near the center of power. But I'm not the center of power, said Peter. I'm not a king. I know who you are, said Valomi. Who am I? He seemed amused. You're Genghis, Washington, Bismarck, a builder of empires, a uniter of peoples, a maker of nations. I'm the breaker of nations, Valomi, said Peter. We'll keep the word nation, but it will come to mean what state means in America, an administrative unit, but little more. India will have a great history, but from now on will have human history. How very noble, said Valomi. This was not going as she intended. I think you don't understand what I'm offering you. You're offering me something I want very much, India in the FPE. But the price you want me to pay is too high. Price? Was he really that stupid? To have me is not a price you pay. It's a sacrifice I make. And who says romance is dead, said Peter. Valomi, you're a battle schooler. Surely you can see why it's impossible for me to marry my way into having India in the FPE. Only then, in the moment of his challenge, did the whole thing become clear. Not the world as she saw it, centered on India, but the world as he saw it, with himself at the center of everything. So it's all about you, said Valomi. You can't share power with another. I can share power with everybody, said Peter, and I already am. Only a fool thinks he can rule alone. You can only rule by the willing obedience and cooperation of those you supposedly rule over. They have to want you to lead them. And if I married you, attractive as the offer is on every count, I would no longer be seen as an honest broker. Instead of trusting me to lead the FPE's foreign and military policy to the benefit of the whole world, I would be seen as tilting everything toward India. Not everything, she said. More than everything, said Peter. I would be seen as the tool of India. You can be sure that Caliph Ali would immediately declare war, not just on India, which has his troops all over it, but on the FPE. I'd be faced with bloody war in Sudan and Nubia, which I don't want. Why would you fear it? Why wouldn't I? He said. You have been, she said. How can Ali stand against you? Well, said Peter, if Bean is so all-powerful and irresistible, why do I need you? Because Bean can never be as fully trusted as a wife, and Bean doesn't bring you a billion people. Valomi, said Peter, I'd be a fool to trust you, wife or not. You wouldn't be bringing India into the FPE, you'd be bringing the FPE into India. Why not a partnership? Because gods don't need mortal partners, said Peter. You've been a god too long. There's no man you can marry as long as you think you're elevating him just by letting him touch you. Don't say what you can't unsay, said Valomi. Don't make me say what's so hard to hear, said Peter. I'm not going to compromise my leadership of the whole FPE just to get one country to join. He meant it. He actually thought his position was above hers. He thought he was greater than India, greater than a god, that he would diminish himself by taking what she offered. But now there was nothing more to say to him. She wouldn't waste time with idle threats. She'd show him what she could do to those who wanted India for an enemy. He rose to his feet. I'm sorry that I didn't anticipate your offer, said Peter. I wouldn't have wasted your time. I had no desire to embarrass you. I thought you would have understood my situation better. I'm just one woman. India is just one country. He winced just a little. He didn't like having his foolish, arrogant words thrown in his face. Well, you'll have more than that thrown at you, Ender's brother. I brought two others to see you, said Peter. If you're willing. He opened a door, and Colonel Graff and a man she didn't know entered the room. "Verlomi, I think you know Minister Graff, and this is Mazur Rackham." She inclined her head, showing no surprise. They sat down and explained their offer. "I already have the love and allegiance of the greatest nation on earth," said Verlomi, "and I have not been defeated by the most terrible enemies that China and the Muslim world could hurl against me. Why should I wish to run and hide in a colony somewhere?" "It's a noble work," said Graf. "It's not hiding, it's building."
"Termites build," said Verlomi.
"And hyenas tear," said Graf.
"I have no need for or interest in the service you offer," said Verlomi.
"No," said Graf. "You just don't see your need yet. You always were hard to get to change your way of looking at things. It's what held you back in battle school, Verlomi."
"You're not my teacher now," said Verlomi.
"Well, you're certainly wrong about one thing, whether I'm your teacher or not," said Graf.
She waited.
"You have not yet faced the most terrible enemies that China and the Muslim world can hurl against you.
Do you think Hansu can get into India again? I'm not Tikal Chapakar.
And he's not the Politburo or Snow Tiger."
"He's Enda's chishmate," she said in mock awe.
"He's not caught up in his own mystique," said Rackham, who had not spoken till now. "For your own sake, Verlomi, take a good, hard look in the mirror. You're what megalomania looks like in the early stages."
"I have no ambition for myself," said Verlomi.
"If you define India as whatever you conceive it to be," said Rackham, "you'll wake up some terrible morning and discover that it is not what you need it to be."
"And you say this from your vast experience of governing. What country was it now, Mr. Rackham?"
Rackham only smiled. "Pride, when poked, gets petty."
"Was that already a proverb?" asked Verlomi. "Or should I write it down?"
"The offer stands," said Graf. "It's irrevocable as long as you live."
"Why don't you make the same offer to Peter?" asked Verlomi. "He's the one who needs to take the long voyage."
She decided she wasn't going to get a better exit line than that, so she walked slowly, gracefully to the door. No one spoke as she departed. Peter did not come to the rail to wave her off. Just another discourtesy. Not that she would have acknowledged him even if he had. As for Graf and Rackham, they'd soon enough be coming to her for funding. No, for permission to operate their little colony ministry. The dhow took her back to a different fishing village from the one she had sailed from. No point in making things easy for Ali if he had discovered her departure from Hyderabad and followed her. She rode a train back to Hyderabad, passing for an ordinary citizen. If any Muslim soldiers should be so bold as to search the train. But the people knew who she was. Whose face was better known in all of India? And not being Muslim, she didn't have to cover her face.
"The first thing I will do when I rule India is change the name of Hyderabad. Not back to Bagnagar. Even though it was named for an Indian woman, the name was bestowed by the Muslim prince who destroyed the original Indian village in order to build the Chaminar, a monument to his own power, supposedly in honor of his beloved Hindu wife. India will never again be obliterated in order to appease the power lust of Muslims. The new name of Hyderabad will be the original name of the village, Chichlam."
She made her way from the train station to a safe house in the city, and from there, her aides helped get her back inside the hut where she had supposedly been meditating and praying for India for the 3 days she had been gone. There she slept for a few hours. Then she arose and sent an aide to bring her an elegant but simple sari, one that she knew she could wear with grace and beauty, and which would show off her slim body to best advantage. When she had it arranged to her satisfaction, and her hair was arranged properly, she walked from her hut to the gate of Hyderabad. The soldiers at the checkpoint gawped at her. No one had ever expected her to try to enter, and they had no idea what to do. While they went through their flurry of asking their superiors inside the city what they should do, Verlomi simply walked inside. They dared not stop her or challenge her. They didn't want to be responsible for starting a war. She knew this place as well as anyone, and knew which building housed Caliph Ali's headquarters. Though she walked gracefully without hurry, it took little time for her to get there. Again, she paid no attention to guards or clerks or secretaries or important Muslim officers. They were nothing to her. By now they must have heard Ali's decision, and his decision was obviously to let her pass, for no one obstructed her. Wise choice. One young officer even trotted along ahead of her, opening doors and indicating which way she should go. He led her into a large room where Ali stood waiting for her, with a dozen high officers standing along the walls. She walked to the middle of the room. "Why are you afraid of one lone woman, Caliph Ali?" Before he had time to answer the obvious truth, that far from being afraid, he had let her pass unmolested and uninspected through his headquarters complex and into his own presence, Valomi began to unwrap her sari. It took only a moment or two before she stood naked before him. Then she reached up and loosened her long hair, and then swung it and combed her fingers through it. "You see that I have no weapon hidden here. India stands before you naked and defenseless. Why do you fear her?" Ali had averted his eyes as soon as it became clear that she was undressing. So had the more pious of the other officers. But some, apparently, thought it was their responsibility to make sure that she was, in fact, weaponless. She enjoyed their consternation, their embarrassment, and, she suspected, their desire. "You came here to ravish India, didn't you? And yet I am out of your reach. Because I'm not here for you, underlings. I'm here for your master." "Leave us," Ali said to the other men. Even the most modest of them could not help but glance at her as they shuffled out of the room, leaving the two of them alone. The door closed behind them. She and Ali were alone. "Very symbolic, Verlomi," said Ali, still refusing to look at her. "That will get talked about." "The offer I make is both symbolic and tangible," she said. "This upstart, Peter Wiggin, has gone as far as he should go. Why should Muslim and Hindu be enemies when together we have the power to crush his naked ambition?" "His ambition isn't as naked as you are," said Ali. "Please put on clothing so I can look at you." "May not a man look at his bride?" Ali chuckled. "A dynastic marriage. I thought you already told Hansu what he could do with that idea." "Hansu had nothing to offer me. You are the leader of the Muslims of India, a large portion of my people torn away from Mother India in fruitless hostility. And why? Look at me, Ali." Either the force of her voice had power over him, or he could not resist his desire, or perhaps he simply decided that since they were alone, he need not keep up the show of perfect rectitude. He looked her up and down, casually, without reaction. As he did, she raised her arms above her head and turned around. "Here is India," she said, "no longer resisting you, no longer evading you, but welcoming you, married to you, fertile soil in which to plant a new civilization of Muslim and Hindu united." She faced him again. He continued to look at her, not bothering to keep his eyes only on her face. "You do intrigue me," he said. "I should think so," she answered silently. "Muslims never have the virtue they pretend to have." "I must consider this," he said. "No," she said. "You think I'll make up my mind in an instant? I don't care, but I will leave this room in moments. Either I'll do it dressed in that sari as your bride, or I'll do it naked, leaving my clothing behind. Naked, I'll pass through your compound, and naked, I'll return to my people.
Let them decide what they think was done to me within these walls. You'd provoke such a war as that, said Alai? Your presence in India is the provocation, Caliph. I offer you peace and unity between our peoples. I offer you the permanent alliance that will enable us together, India and Islam, to unite the world in a single government and along the way cast Peter Wigan aside. He was never worthy of his brother's name. He's wasted enough of the time and attention of the world. She walked closer to him until her knees touched his.